Okay, we've had a wonderful weekend of learning, wonderful morning of learning, Achron Chaviv, and I just want to thank the Beit for hosting the program, being so open and gracious. This program, many of the other programs we've been here, are the Rav Karofkin, for all his wonderful work and being the moderator of the panel. And of course, I want to also thank Elaine Genisov, who I know works unbelievably hard. I don't know if everybody appreciates, but I know working with her in many programs how hard she works and how dedicated. And it's have a wonderful, wonderful congregation, and it's a pleasure to be here. And with that, I'll let Rabbi Karofkin take over.
Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. Good morning, everyone. And I just want to say thank you to Rabbi Jay Kelman, because Torah in Motion is such an important organization for our community. It's really a rarity in the Jewish world. And we always can rely on you to provide our communities, our larger Jewish community in Toronto and worldwide, with really provocative, inspiring and educational programs. So we're really so enriched by your, by everything you're doing. It's really an honor for the Bayit, and again, thanks to Elaine Genisov from our end. But it's really an honor for us to be able to host these tremendously distinguished scholars. For the last session today, we're going to try and think about the large questions about the study of Jewish history. I've been asked to give the bios very briefly of our three distinguished guest scholars. Rabbi Dr. Zev Elif is Chief Academic Officer of the Hebrew Theological College in Skokie and Associate Professor of Jewish History at Touro College. He also serves as Research Director of Mission Measurements Jewish Impact Genome. So I'm going to hold it. I'll sit down in a second. He is the author or editor of 9 books and more than 40 scholarly articles in the field of American Jewish history. His Who Rules the Synagogue in Modern Orthodox Judaism were both finalists for the National Jewish Book Award. His Authentically Orthodox, A Tradition-Bound Faith in American Life is due out in the fall of 2019. Dr. Leslie Ginsparg Klein is the Academic Dean of Women's Institute of Torah Seminary Ma'alot in Baltimore, an Orthodox Jewish seminary and college for women. An accomplished scholar and author, Dr. Klein has lectured across the U.S. and internationally and taught at Gratz College, Touro College, and Hebrew Theological College. Dr. Klein received her Ph.D. in Education and Jewish Studies from NYU, where she researched the history of Orthodox girls' education in America and the Beis Yaakov movement. She's an alumna of Michlala, Stern College for Women, and the Wexner Graduate Fellowship. Have the street creds, and a recipient of the New York Jewish Week's 36 Under 36 Award. Dr. Klein is on the editorial board of Lair House and the founder and director of Girls Night On, a not-for-profit organization that promotes Jewish women in music and the arts. And I think I saw your slam poetry. That was really cool. Dr. Klein lives in Baltimore with her husband and children. And finally, Dr. Mark B. Shapiro. Holds the Weinberg Chair in Judaic Studies at the University of Scranton. A graduate of Brandeis and Harvard Universities, he is the author of numerous articles and reviews and is a popular scholar in residence at synagogues around the world. He has also written Between the Yeshiva World and Modern Orthodoxy and The Limits of Orthodox Theology, both of which were National Jewish Book Award finalists. Other books of his include Saul Lieberman and the Orthodox and Studies in Maimonides and His Interpreters. His newest book, Changing the Immutable, How Orthodox Judaism Rewrites Its History, appeared in 2015. Since we're coming up to Pesach, I thought I'd put out for our guests 4 questions. Now, they can choose which questions they would like to answer. They can answer one, they can answer a different question, but I just thought these are things that just occurred to me when Rabbi Kelman asked me to moderate. And sort of with a hat tip to Rabbi Dr. Elif, the large question is like the Manishtana overarching question is, what do we hope to gain as teachers of Jewish history? That's really the overarching question, and you can mold that question as you'd like. But specifically, here are my four questions. We live in a postmodern orthodoxy where most everything is questioned. We've dismissed so much of Torah biographies as fanciful hagiography. At the same time, we are able to gain a more accurate picture of the past. What have we gained and lost in the process of using a more precise and scientific method of studying Jewish history? Question number two. Specifically, it's been suggested that medieval and ancient history have become less popular in Jewish study departments and universities than modern history. If you agree, why is that, and do you lament or laud the new focus? Question number three. How do you think history scholars in 50 or 100 years from now will reflect upon the state of world Jewry today? And question number four, we often hear of new practices within Orthodoxy, such as the shidduch resume and the obscuring of women's faces from Jewish printed materials. Some rabbonim argue that these innovations are in keeping with the Mesorah of past generations. How does the study of Jewish history help respond to this line of argumentation? In general, how can historiography help to better deal with when to innovate versus when to maintain the past traditions? Okay, and now that's it for me. We're just going to listen now. Who would like to go first?
Okay, so first of all, the overarching question. Is this on?
No. You want to use this one?
It is on. Okay. So I'll tackle the first, and thank you to Rabbi Karapkin. Really, I'll echo. Olana and Jay Kelman have just been transformative. This is really just such a wonderful thing, and to be sit beside really terrific historians and teachers of Jewish history, and at a place like the Bayit is just, it's really wonderful. So the first question that Rabbi Karapkin posed was about the scientific, and of course, even science isn't so scientific at a certain tier. With the academic or scholarly Jewish history and sort of how we have deposed the hagiography, the so-called art scroll biography, there aren't as many art scroll biographies as we may think, and they're not the only ones who do it. When we've sort of put them on a different table, on a different bookshelf, what is gained and lost? It's an interesting question. I think first and foremost is what Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi put forward is the difference between Jewish history and Jewish memory. I think in terms of whether you call it heritage or memory, true or not, and again, there's something very much in between true and not true. Memory is critically important. It's a currency. It's a usable past, and that's sacred. And part of it is lost when historians function as mythbusters to say something didn't happen. And truth is, there's good reason for that. But something is lost. Some of the warmth of Jewish memory is lost through the very programmatic and wordiness of a footnote. And maybe a solution would be something one of my teachers at Harvard, David Hall, really started a movement in American history, which is lived religion. And that's really how I write history. I'm less concerned with what one or two or three people did, although those one or two, three people might have been Rosh Yeshiva or founders of movements, male, female. But I'm really interested in what the rank and file do or what they did. I'm interested in things like bracha bees. I'm interested in kidney oat and peanut oil, for example. I'm also interested in what people like the Lubavitcher Rebbe and Reform leaders or Rabbi Soloveitchik or Aaron Cutler, what they did in my research in American Jewish history. But if that's not anchored in what Hall calls lived religion, then how to make sense of it? So what? It's a so what question. That major and impactful people did something, but if you can't prove the reception, if you can't prove the posterity and the persistence of historical or cultural change, then what utility and what can we learn from it? And so when we talk about lived religion, how religion plays out, not just in shuls, and not just in sermons, forgive me, but also, and then those are important, but how to trace the reception of that, how to combine that in a larger discussion with how all the other Jews or all the other human beings did something. That's a way to wed the historical memory and also the history qua history.
I'll just add, I mean, I also, in the first chapter of my last book, I wrote a lot about heritage, but I have to be honest and say, and I like the question, that real history, you do lose a lot. You mentioned here, actually, I didn't use the word, but reverence. There's no question about it, and it raises another issue. I mean, Midrash is a form of hagiography to a large extent. I mean, already the Maritz Chayas mentions this, that the writers of the Midrash set out, for example, to portray Esav in a much more worse light than he appears in the text. I mean, Esav really represents Rome. And other figures are portrayed much better. They might be neutral in the text. And this is really not about the figures per se. It's about putting forth messages, teaching morality, all sorts of other things. But once you have a historical sense, and I'm told from people in Israel this is an issue, they find it hard to relate to Midrash. You often find, I know the new Israeli schools of Tanakh study, they don't want Midrash. They all want Pshat. So I don't really know. Once the genie's out of the bottle and we're more historically inclined, it's very hard to then explain, you know, what's the value then of these portrayals, because people today want the truth. Of course, I would say that truth doesn't have to mean historical truth. There's different truths as well. But I was having this argument with my son the other day because he said to his Rebbe, and his Rebbe agreed, that, you know, why, you know, this story never happened. So then, but I need to then explain to my son, well then, why does it appear in the Midrash if it never actually happened? It didn't happen. I mean, the Rambam tells us that certain stories in Torah never happened either historically, but they're recorded. So it's recorded for a reason. So, and that I think is a real challenge, which the more you get into history, and I think it's an important challenge in the Orthodox community, because it's not just a question of a certain gadol that now we know it wasn't like what it said. This gets us into the heart of our religion, because our religion is based on Midrashic texts. We read Rashi every week, and I think it's hard to convince people of the importance of these things, even if it's not necessarily historically true. I mean, the Rambam understood this, and he explained what the purpose of Midrash is. But I deal with high school students a lot, it's very, very difficult. They reach a point where they say, if it's not historically true, then it's nonsense, I don't want it. And I've read about, as I said, people in Israel, all they care about is Pshat. But that's not our tradition. Pshat is only one aspect of it. So I think this question really goes into much wider areas.
Dr. Shapiro, I'm sorry, Dr. Klein, if I could just, if I could poke you a little bit. I don't mean to poke you. I mean, so the question that I'd like to ask you is, aren't you the guy who opened the genie's bottle? In other words, your latest book really does expose a tremendous amount of inaccuracies in Jewish history, and that's a part and parcel of your writings, of your expertise in Jewish scholarship. Do you feel, in a sense, that you've contributed to this erosion, if it is an erosion, and do you feel that you need to write now a book on Midrash to counterbalance it?
Well, what I will say is there are many people who wrote to me and they said, well, what about Masorah? You know, if I'm showing you that in certain times people twisted the truth in order to put forth a certain approach, what about the fact that we have a Masorah? But I also write about in the book, in the introduction there, that truth, there's different types of truth. A myth could preserve certain truths. They're not historical truths, but they're valuable truths. So whether you need a new book or not, so perhaps yes, but if you recall, I do mention that, and I was accused of being the great art scroll apologist. Now, how could I be the art scroll apologist? Because I show that they didn't make this up, that this is a tradition. I remember we had an interview when I came here, and we spoke about some of these issues. History, we write modern history, and I understand that, and it has certain implications, but Jews traditionally did not write that, and history was thought to be, have certain inspirational goals, etc. The Midrash is a different area. You don't need Mark Shapiro for that. When you start reading Midrash and you know about history, then you're asking yourself, and the Maritz Chayas, as I said, deals with it, What then, as you as a rabbi, you've been approached, if someone were to ask you, well, did this really happen? I mean, and if not, then what's the value of, you know, that we have disputes, you know, did Slefka do this? Did he do that? I mean, if we don't know, I mean, or if you can be sure that it didn't happen, if we have a portrayal of, let's say, Titus or something, you know, what are they trying to tell us? What do you tell students, you know, about things like that?
Right, and the difficulty between written explanations and oral dialogues with students is that a teacher can gauge, you know, and Maimonides talks about this a lot in his introduction to Moré Nevuchim, is that there's an inherent danger of putting out a text because it's out there for everyone. There are certain people who, to quote Jack Nicholson, can't handle the truth, right? And the question therefore becomes, when we put out a piece of literature that's accessible to even those who can't handle the truth, what is our responsibility?
So I think what this requires with the Midrash question is we need good teachers of Midrash. That Midrash has never been understood, you know, by our great commentators as history the way we think of it. Unfortunately, it's often been taught as if it's history. Of course, the larger issue you raise is about, you know, what I wrote about the Gedolim. I completely acknowledge that certain people's feeling of reverence could be affected by knowing real stories about them. On the other hand, and Nassim Kamenetsky mentions this in the introduction to his book, if you don't feel respect for a gadol when you know the real history, then maybe he shouldn't be respected as a gadol. That's basically what he points out, that it's important for us to know. We're educated consumers. As I said before, we're not like the church, where the church tells you this is going to be your priest and your bishop. We make the gedolim, and we have to know them. The Chazon Ish says that there's no issue of Lashon Hara when it comes to the gedolim, because we need to know about who they are. And if a certain great rabbi in his private life is a scoundrel, he can't be our teacher. We need to know that. And I dare say, and I've studied, you know, the gedolim very intensively, that the more you learn about the real gedolim, the more impressed you get. So I'm not that worried about myself, about the real history. But I understand for some people it could be a little jarring. But for people who live in sophisticated communities, if you're going to read a sophisticated biography of Lyndon Johnson, let's say, or of Abraham Lincoln, you're not going to be satisfied with anything less. And our gedolim are of the sort, or they wouldn't be gedolim if we cannot understand them seriously. And I'll tell you that in the Haredi world, there's a whole range of academics and intellectuals, and they agree with this entirely, that it's just they don't feel that this is something for the masses. But they definitely support this, and they believe in it. Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Klein.
Sorry. Okay, so a few points. First, if I'm wearing my Jewish studies hat, okay, I'm teaching a class in Jewish studies, so I point out to students the difference between emet, between truth, and between historical accuracy. And there's a difference there. You have two midrashim that conflict. Okay, they both didn't happen. So which one was historically accurate? Maybe it doesn't matter, because the question you want to be asking is, what was each one coming to teach? And I think that Mark was talking about that to some extent, that the purpose of Midrash wasn't to provide history. So we can't really look at it as history. But what we can ask ourselves is, what is the emet of this Midrash? What is the truth here? What are we supposed to learn? What are we supposed to learn from this story versus what are we supposed to learn from that story? Now, putting on my historian's hat, I'm going to challenge the premise of this question, because the premise of this question suggests that if we have a more accurate picture of the past, then it's less inspirational. And I'm going to argue that that's not true. I read hagiography, and I don't find it inspiring. And I'm not the only one. There is a famous letter to Rev Huttner, where one of his students asked about these kind of hagiographies and how they were kind of making him depressed, because it seemed like all of the, to be a great leader, to be a gadol, was unattainable, because, you know, you have to be a genius that's memorized in the entire Shas backwards by the time you're five. So, and Rev Huttner responds, critical of these books, and says that there's actually a lot that people can learn from seeing the struggles of our leaders, that really is inspiring. And no one wants to say today that a certain gadol played basketball, But I think that's actually very inspiring to see, like, hey, he was a regular person. He played basketball, and he went on to be a great leader. I like sports. I could also be a great leader, as opposed to pictures that portray our leaders, Gedolim, I'm going to add Gedolot, okay, our leaders, male and female, that as perfect from day one. Maybe we need to rethink what's actually inspiring, especially in this generation. On Shabbat, in the morning, I spoke about Sarah Schneer, and I spoke about hagiographies of her, and I, to some extent, tore them down and showed how they were inaccurate. But my message was that ultimately, when you understand the real story of Sarah Schneer and what she accomplished overcoming adversity, it's actually so much more inspiring than what we think about as the hagiographic accounts. And I think that that's ultimately true across the board, that there is so much inspiration in what is real history.
Okay. Thank you. Would anyone like to continue along in the discussion of some of the other questions?
Sure. I'll take number two, but I'll actually transition from one to two. I'll give just a more concrete example. Dr. Klein mentioned the hagiography surrounding Sarah Schneer, but I'll actually take it in a different direction. Talk about the purpose of history and also the question of why certain areas like modern seem to be more in vogue than ancient or medieval Jewish history. One art scroll biography that appeared not too long ago was one on Rav Gifter. I was disappointed. I was disappointed. Compare that to, and Rav Aaron Feldman wrote a terrific review long ago of the Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky biography, which was really sui generis as a really wonderful biography. And this is not art school bashing at all, but the author of the Rav Gifter biography didn't teach me much about how Rav Gifter became Rav Gifter. He didn't tell me much about his Derech HaLimud. I learned how Rav Gifter was a tzaddik, but the author fit a remarkable Talmud Chacham into a template in which I didn't learn much new from the Rav Gifter biography that I would have. We're still waiting for a very important biography on this Rosh Hashiva, which gets me into the question of why, what do we hope to gain in terms of Jewish history? I look at there are different pockets of wisdom. The ultimate wisdom, from my point of view, is Torah. And there aren't competing wisdoms, but there are other forms of wisdom which are useful, which have utility. Some might be physics, some might be computer science, some might be psychology, and history is certainly a discipline which offers some wisdom. One that we've mentioned a lot of U.S. presidents, I've realized, but Woodrow Wilson, who's also a university president, for that matter, talked about how history was a form of really ascertaining a high level of judgment. You have better judgment, said President Woodrow Wilson, when you understand history that much better. That's helpful. I'm less interested if my students know that Rashi lived from 1040 to 1105. I'm less interested to know if people know that the first Jews arrived to the New World in 1654. I'm much more interested in how they grapple with certain issues, how they refine their powers of analysis, and I teach in a Jewish college, so I'm also very interested in how they form their identity and how they understand the present. Very often historians abdicate relevancy, say that what I study in 17th century France is for 17th century France and it's for no other period. I think there's a certain level of truth to that, but if there isn't utility to our history to inform sounder and more refined forms of judgment, then what we are rather boring storytellers rather than teachers to help a next generation of young people really move throughout our current history, our present, with sounder skills and use that wisdom for the betterment of our Jewish people and also for mankind.
Rabbi Elif, do you feel, just getting back to your discussion of the difference between the Rav Gifter biography and the Rav Kamenetsky biography, published both by Art Scroll, Do you feel that the fact that they're divided by approximately two decades may have something to do with the difference?
It's interesting. The reception history and what people are interested in. I don't know. We have to think. I have to think more about it. Certainly, the Rybakov the author of the Rybakov biography is a remarkable writer and scholar. Not saying anything about the author of the Rybgifter biography. You just remember. My point is that. So I think that I have to think more. But what I learned from the Rybakov isn't that I too. Could write the Amosliakov. I am not suggesting anything of the sort. But I understand the placement of Rybakov and his contributions and a certain legacy that moves us forward. I appreciate the Amosliakov so much. I also appreciate Rybgifter. And I'm looking for the information for what do I do as a Jew, as an Orthodox Jew, for that matter. What do I take from Rybgifter? What do I take about the Telzer Derech? And how do I move that forward? I was trained as a Brisker.
All right. So is this part of your explanation as to why you feel that more modern history is more informative for us and can teach us more?
So I personally, I'm a modern historian. I locate most of my scholarship in America, but I'm informed by the currents of European modern Jewish history. Number one, it's far less heretical than in the ancient or in the medieval period. So it's much easier to navigate myself. There's a comfort level just personally for that. But I do think that it informs. I don't say that in terms of the academy, it's absolutely true that there are fewer jobs in ancient history, not Talmudic literature. Talmud as a literature, there were several jobs this past year, most notably at the University of Pennsylvania. But medieval, there is certainly, we're at a nadir, so I suspect, both in the conferences and in the job placement in ancient and medieval, in terms of history. I think in many ways that we think that I don't know if it's true, but we've saturated the field with a certain level of scholarship. But I think also the need to teach Holocaust in universities is critically important. That's always offered in the course catalogs, so a modernist would be able to do it. But I also think we are looking to make the humanities relevant once more. And I think that many Jewish studies departments and search committees are looking to the modernists to reestablish.
Dr. Klein?
So I want to answer this question from two perspectives, first from the academic perspective, and then from the perspective of a high school teacher, which I have taught high school in the past. So from an academic perspective, I am also a modern historian, also focused mainly in America. I made that choice, most primarily because that's where my interests lie. And there's also the element that I also wasn't going to touch medieval and ancient. It was very difficult from that kfira, from that balancing that perspective, which you don't have with modern history. So there was that element. But I really wanted to understand the progression of the Jewish community, kind of how we ended up where we are today. I wanted to understand that through study of the past. And I feel like you get that more from modern history, certainly in the areas of gender history and women's education that I was specifically interested in. I also, from the perspective, now I want to switch to my experience is 5 years teaching at a Jewish community high school. So the purpose of the Jewish history curriculum in a high school, and again, this is so different from when you're in academia, but the purpose of the curriculum in high school is to build Jewish identity. And I think that's globally the purpose of a day school education and Jewish history, wherever it's taught. I've heard that in some schools here it's not taught. That's so horrifying to me, I can't even start. But where Jewish history is taught, it's about identity. Okay, so I'm thinking back to my experiences in high school. I had 3 years of Jewish history, about 2 years and 7 months were spent on ancient and medieval, maybe a couple of months on modern, the Holocaust, and we ended history in 1948. That's it. That's where history ends. And I remember one of my major projects senior year, and I want to stress that My instructor, my teachers, they were fabulous. I'm not putting this on them. This is what curriculum looked like. Okay, this is what curriculum looked like in the 90s, and I don't know that it's changed so much today. Okay, one of my final projects was to compose like a history of anti-Semitism. So go through history and list all the different anti-Semitic acts that befell the Jews, and I had a little color-coded legend, like a little star for when they had to wear yellow stars and a symbol for ghettos, and I have my annotated list. That's the message we want to give. I mean, Jewish history is a story of persecution of anti-Semitism. That's so depressing. Like, it's just depressing. So in my own teaching, we tried very hard to focus on those elements of Jewish history that would really spark kind of the enjoyment of being Jewish, the greatness, the things that were more inspiring. But still, what I was fighting against as a teacher, how little time is devoted to modern Jewish history, and I don't get it. I don't get it. So for me, is this I think more of a focus on modern, certainly in our education, is a good thing, because I don't think that students today relate to the ancient and medieval the way they relate to modern. I don't think that it's as easy to and compelling to give the lessons that will help build identity today in ancient and medieval. I think it's easier in modern. I think it's so much more interesting, and students can connect so much more in understanding really how the community today became the community today. And yet we like stuff that to the very end of senior year and spend years talking about the Crusades and you know the ancient medieval. And I don't get it, and I have tried as a teacher to kind of push back against it. I also agree with Zeb. There's something so inspiring about daily life. I don't know if you answered that in the first question or the second question, but you know, I teach a class on modern Jewish history that focuses on social history. Okay, if you were Jewish, you were living in that time, what would your life be like? Now, this is a course that I teach on the college level, but in an Orthodox school. And I teach it from an academic perspective. Purely, I teach it in an academic perspective. And yet I constantly get the feedback how inspiring this course was. Okay, purely academic perspective, not with the goal of building Jewish identity, just let's look at what it was like to be Jewish. And if I'm teaching a class of women with a great focus on what was it like to be a Jewish woman in this time, and those sources do exist. If you haven't read the memoirs of Glickle of Hamelin, get it and read it. It's a fabulous book, right? And yet I get the message, wow, this is so inspiring. Because there is something inherently inspiring about modern Jewish history and understanding that experience.
Thank you. Before we go to Dr. Shapiro, I'm fascinated because Dr. Klein, you teach in by definition, it's what we would call a non-academic milieu, ma'alot, which is for girls young ladies who have graduated high school. Could be.
Someone in your family.
Yeah, could be. But yeah, yeah. Anyway, but so perhaps your perspective in what you feel the students need to attain may be different from someone like Dr. Shapiro, who's in a purely, I guess, a secular academic setting,
right.
Or in your case, a Catholic setting in the University of Scranton. But to Dr. Shapiro, okay, so you've heard from two of your colleagues who feel that there's more for us to gain from studying modern history than studying ancient and medieval, and as a scholar of different eras.
That's not to say there's nothing.
Right, right. But
Dr. Allen would agree.
But and of course we heard the word kfira, which is this fear that the further back we get in Jewish history, the more we're going to be flirting with heresy. What is your feeling about that?
Okay, before I get to that, though, I do want to make another point relevant to what they both were saying, that which I think is significant. And you mentioned I teach at a Catholic university. I can guarantee you if you'd go to the local church and someone were to say that, you know, there's a lecture Sunday night at 8 p.m. or whenever on Pope Boniface, you know, and his approach to certain thing, no one's coming. I mean, if you do it at a university, you might get a few people. And when you think about, there's something amazing that, well, just let me look around this room, but like all of us speak at places, I have summer trips, you know, you go somewhere and you could have 50 people, you could have 100, you could have 300 people who want to hear about a historical topic. Where else do you have this? If you say you want to speak about Woodrow Wilson, who's coming in? You want to speak about a great rabbi at the beginning of the century, speak on the Netziv, let's say, and you can get lots of people in all the different communities. I had the privilege a couple of years ago speaking in Flatbush, and they were coming from Williamsburg, everything, all the... So that is something that's unique, basically, to our group. And I think, and it shows you how history, however much I only began to write just regular history, but for many people, it's also of existential significance. And I think the reason for this is, and I don't know if this is a good thing or a bad thing, but we are a people who are trained in Torah study, and people are very interested in that. But not everyone's interested, let's say, in learning halacha. They're not interested in learning Talmud, but they want to be connected. And that really explains how so many people view history as a form of limud Torah, and there is Torah involved, certainly what I deal with, there is, but in all aspects that we see this as part of our identity, and I see it as sort of an outgrowth. I've been told by people in the more right-wing world that this is a problem. I know someone once criticized a lecture series I was at, not here, but it could be the similar thing, saying, well, if they really cared, they'd have shiurim. Instead, they're having lectures. But the fact of the matter is that many people, they go to shiurim, but they're not so much in touch with it. And the things we speak about, all of us speak about, are interesting. And they're interesting not just because they're tidbits of the past, they're of existential interest. And it's a fascinating phenomenon that the historian or the scholar of Jewish philosophy has really become part of the model of the teacher in the Orthodox world. And that's very interesting. And Torah in Motion, of course, is people listen to the talks all over the world, and people find it fascinating in many ways, some just intellectual, others spiritual. So it's something about our era, the whole idea of, you know, the lectures, which I think is significant. Now, as for the other point, I don't know. First, we don't have time. You have to have a whole other session. You know, what is heresy? I mean, Samuel Johnson once said that... we're not sure we're not sure exactly when dusk is. But because we're not sure exactly when dusk is, that doesn't mean that we don't know when it's light and when it's dark. We can all agree when it's light, and we can all agree when it's dark, night and day. Dusk, that's we're not so sure. In our tradition also, you know, Benishmas, we're not so sure. We can all agree that certain things are kosher. We can all agree that certain things are treif. The disputes that we often have are in the middle, where in some circles it's treif, no good, other circles it is. And that's, you know, it's very hard to come down on that. That's been a dispute, people might say, since the Rambam's day. It goes back to the Talmudic times. So there's no question that in more of these areas, when you get back further, it's problematic. But you have it in modern times, too. In many circles, concluding that Rav Yonasan Leibschitz was a heretic and a Sabbatian would be worse than concluding that the Zohar was a medieval work. That would be worse than that. So there's these issues also in modern times as well. In many circles, making certain conclusions about Hasidic Rebbes, we'd regard it as even worse. And in terms of the past, we've seen changes. Yaakov Ellman, some of you probably knew him personally, a great scholar at YU, an unbelievable genius, one who I had the pleasure of knowing, obviously you did as well. When you read the stuff that he writes about the Talmudic period, there is no way that that would have been regarded as acceptable at Yeshiva University years ago. I think today some people won't regard it as acceptable, but that is exactly the sort of thing that Samson Raphael Hirsch said was heretical, and without a doubt would have been regarded in modern orthodoxy as heretical years ago. The things that you teach at Bar-Ilan University, higher criticism of books of Nach, that years ago would have been regarded as out of the fold. So we're seeing changes. And for those who don't know, Yaakov Ellman spoke about enormous Persian influence, not just on Agadot, things like that, but even on the Jewish law, Hilchos Nida, other things. And I can see how this could be very problematic. And this is someone, a Talmudic scholar of enormous dimensions, who comes out not of our world, comes out of, maybe because he came out of Rav Huttner with this more open-minded approach to thing. But so that would be an example where in certain circles they would say that's obviously heresy until they say who's saying it. Unfortunately, in our world sometimes things are called heresy, and you know what, it's not heresy, but you say, but Chassam Sofer said it. And then it's not heresy, because it can't be, because the Chasam Sofer said it. So often what defines something as heresy is not what's said, but who says it.
I'll make just two points, probing a little bit deeper. Number one, I teach medieval Jewish history every year. I teach two courses every semester, and one time I always teach medieval Jewish history. And it's interesting to think about it. One time I taught a history, I built an entire course called The History of the Jewish Community in Chicago. I teach in Skokie, Illinois, in Chicago. It fell flat. These students were totally uninterested in learning about, and many of these are second, third, fourth generation Chicago. It's kind of like Toronto. When I teach medieval Jewish history, particularly to young men, and I talk about, and when we read Avraham Grossman in Rashi's workshop, and I bring in as a primary text the Hakdama to Mishneh Torah, a little studied but incredibly informative and interesting document, I guess with yeshiva-trained men, they're peaked, I think. Or else they put on a good show. And I wonder if there's not something gendered. And maybe when we have to really try to flip the lenses to focus on who is our audience. Because for maybe somebody who's coming directly after 2 or 3 years at a KBY or at a Beis Yisrael, they're floored to deepen their understanding. And many of the times it's who's teaching it. So they trust me. I'm their provost. They have no choice. And so there is a familiarity and a trust that transpires, and this transaction of knowledge is actually informing what they're doing in the morning and the afternoon in the Beis Medrash. And for me, that's very deep. And I read that literature. I would never publish. Avraham Grossman doesn't need me to infiltrate his Rashi scholarship. The other area, I was thinking as Dr. Shapiro was talking about our era, and what does that begin in terms of when do we become very historical minded? And I don't have an answer, but Tradition Magazine, the RCA's journal, was published first in 1958. In about 1970s, they realized they were onto something pretty important, and they published A Treasury of Tradition. And they published the best essays, what they thought were the best essays, and they sorted them based on category. There was criticism in there, not criticism of it, but the genre of criticism, of critique. There was Jewish thought, there was halacha. There wasn't a category called history. And in fact, most of the editors of Tradition, save for one who actually had the shortest tenure, have been philosophers, have been people who are ensconced in that world and not in history. And I'm thinking about people whose shoulders I sit atop, people like David Berger, Dr. Berger, or my beloved teacher, Rabbi J.J. Schachter, and what they did to make us more historical-minded. And really, maybe in the 80s onward, is something really interesting. And thinking about when is it appropriate, even to call a history class a shir, that does happen.
Okay, very good. Would anyone like to tackle the third question? How do you think history scholars in 50 years or 100 years from now will reflect upon the state of world Jewry today? What is our era?
It's always dangerous for historians. We talk about the past, not the future. I think there's no question, though, that we've seen in our lifetime the transference of the center of world Jewry to the land of Israel. And that's going to continue more and more. And both in the Torah world, there's no question in the Torah world, it used to not be this case. All the great poskim are there. The great yeshivas are there. Everyone, even in this country, they go to study there. But even leaving aside the religious element, that is, it's now the most populous place for Jews. And as the assimilation continues, it'll grow even more. And really, the center of Jewish cultural life, in this, the Achad Am sense, that this, the land of Israel should be the center of Jewish culture, that has really come to fruition. I know Jacob Neusner used to like to speak about Israel and Babylonia, and that America was Bavel. But as time goes on, it'll become, as Bavel decreased and declined, we're going to see that. And really, Kimitzion Heitzei Torah, Torah in all its senses, secular and Jewish, I think that's the most important thing. We're seeing it as we speak now. The transference of the center of everything really important Jewishly is coming out of the land of Israel.
Are we the first generation of the beginning of the demise of diaspora Jewry?
We've already been seeing it. I mean, maybe the second generation already. In America, we now see with the Pew Report, we see the conservative movement, basically it's collapsed. The Reform movement, which numerically is still strong, but from a halachic standpoint, lots of these people are not Jewish. So I don't know the situation in Canada, but we'll always have Jews in America. We'll always have Jews in the countries that I go to. But if you're looking where the influence is coming from, I think more and more, I mean, in the modern Orthodox world, you know, how many of the best and the brightest in the modern Orthodox world we lose to Aliyah? So on the one hand, that's great, because if it's a movement preaches Aliyah and Zionism, isn't that the fruition? On the other hand, our communities have suffered. If I'm not mistaken, in Chicago, where you're from, they have had many successes moving to Israel, but that's also led to a sharp decline in the modern Orthodox world there. So is that a victory or not? But
Toronto, that's really been a story. Okay.
So I think we're seeing really we see now already the beginnings of what's going to be the great Israeli era, and the diaspora era is coming to an end the way we knew it.
Okay. Any other distinctive markings of our period as far as, let's say, religious commitment, you know, Dr. Shapiro touched upon, or a new phenomenon in Bible study today where even Orthodox Jews are looking into different ways of studying Tanakh, Bible criticism, and so forth. Is that one of the distinctive markers of our generation? What about the sharper or starker divide within Orthodoxy? Is there a greater, will history reflect kindly upon the different kinds of factionalism that we're seeing within Orthodoxy today?
So I'll be brief. I think one is there's going to be a methodological problem. Fewer board meetings are being recorded in minutes, and I hope that that everybody somehow, some way, donates their Gmail to archives. We have a problem of the proliferation of texts, but a different type of text is going to be a real problem. I do hope they invoke Billy Joel and they talk about how we didn't start the fire. I do think that we are seeing new ideas, but different trends. They will hopefully point out that as we become more splintered, they will also look at people like Rabbi Hirsch and Rabbi Hildesheimer and say that there were analogs that we did or did not learn from in the past. My daughter asked me, what's going to happen, Dad, when you're in Mashiach, you're an American Jewish historian, there's probably not going to be a need for you in Israel. I said, I'm a Levi, I'll be the garbage man for the Beis HaMikdash. It'll shake out one way or another.
I mean, the first thing that I could say is I hope they reflect on us kindly. You know, historians can be a little critical sometimes. I'm critical of past eras. I hope that they do look at our world in the context of our world. I think that technology is something that is extremely significant in our era. That when you talk about in Israel and a diaspora, the fact that there is technology and that Israel and diaspora can speak on a daily basis, the fact that someone gives a speech, writes an article in Israel, and the diaspora has it less than a second later, is also going to break down those lines to a great extent. And what differentiates, geographic differentiation is going to become different as, you know, the world globalizes. I mean, technology is doing that. Technology also, I think about that as well with the sources, that I struggle to find sources. We talked about this over Shabbat, that sometimes you have something great you want to write about, but the sources are just not there. Whereas this generation, the historians that are going to look at this generation are going to have so many sources that I don't even know what they're going to do with them.
But they won't have the private letters because everyone sends emails.
Right, that's right.
So that's the problem.
Right.
Yeah. But they'll have the metadata and the reception history. They'll be able to get at truth in different, more interesting ways and be able to measure impact.
Right. There's stories. So one of the things that I struggle with in my research on girls' education is to get the girls' point of view. It's very easy to get the school leadership's point of view. That's in many places. How do you know what actual students were thinking? And I looked hard to find, you know, dissent. You have to look. You have to read between the lines in the 60s, 70s, 80s. You have to read between the lines to find dissent. You know, students who are upset. You need to do oral history interviews. Okay, once you get to the 90s, the 21st century, all you got to do is go online. I mean, there are blogs dedicated to graduates of Beis Yaakov sharing their crazy stories of life in Beis Yaakov. You can find it anywhere. I mean, you know, with you, there's so many more instances of it's so much easier to find students' voices. Now you have to temper that, of course, with the whole culture of online, which is kind of a culture of complaint to some extent, you know, culture of outrage. You know, so you have to temper that as well. But, you know, it's interesting. Over Shabbos, I quoted a Facebook post. It's a public Facebook post, and that's all going to become part of the historical record. Instagram is going to be part of the historical record, and that is interesting to think about, and it does give a lot of sources. It does give a lot of sources, and this kind of leads into the next question.
Yeah. Be careful what you put on social media.
Oh, my God, be careful what you put on social media. It is there forever.
So, Dr. Klein, if I could ask you to reflect on this last question,
yes.
Because the sort of, I guess we could call it the uses and abuses of history.
Mm-hmm.
There is so much that is new that is defended as being part of a Mesorah.
Right.
And especially as it pertains to women's issues. I've been wondering if you could comment on that, and maybe we'll ask
sure.
our other guests as well.
There's a story that I absolutely love. It's from a book recently published. The author is Karen Skenazy, and I can't remember the exact title. It's Women of Valor, like Orthodox Troll Fighters. It's a really great title. She looks about different representations of Orthodoxy in the media. And she tells a story. She was interviewing a man in London, who was part of the group that they don't allow women to drive. If you're aware of this, there's a big population in England. I mean, it's in America, too, and I'm sure it's in Canada as well. Okay, they don't let women to drive. It is not tsniut. It's not modest for women to drive. So she interviews him and says, well, why doesn't your wife drive? Well, it's our Mesorah that women don't drive. It's our tradition. So, of course, there's an element that's laughable. I mean, how long have people even been driving that you can say there's a Mesorah? But more than that, does your mother drive? Oh, yes, my mother drives. Okay, so it's totally an innovation of the past couple of years. Okay, it's an innovation, but every innovation is couched as Mesorah. This is our tradition. A tradition that literally didn't exist until this generation, but now it's our tradition. So we see this with the idea of obscuring women's faces. So a couple of months ago, Mishpacha magazine made a claim that, you know, that really came from the Israeli Mishpacha magazine, that Orthodox publications have never printed pictures of women. You know, Haredi publications have never printed pictures of women. And I wrote a response, which went a little bit, it was a Facebook post that went a little viral, okay, of, I did my dissertation research on Haredi publications of the past 70 years. How many examples of pictures of women do you want me to show you? I mean, it's just not true. It's an innovation of the 21st century, but it's presented as Haya Hove V'yihyeh. This is how it was, this is how it is, this is how it always be. It's our Mesorah. Okay, again, it's ludicrous to say that there's a Mesorah of women's pictures in publications. How many years have there even been really pictures in publications? Even, you know, it was very rare to have a photo in a publication. It was very expensive to print. Okay, that said, when they're claiming 70 years ago in the 40s, there were no pictures of women, so I can get you pictures of women throughout the 20th century. And really, it's only with the popularization of Mishpacha and these other glossy magazines in the early 2000s that suddenly it became the communal norm in that community that women's pictures not only aren't published, but they are never published. So then there's the claim, okay, it's not the Mesorah of the Litvish population, so these Litvish publications should have pictures, but it's the Mesorah of the Hasidic population. And then a couple of weeks ago, this video went viral of this interview on an Israeli program of a publisher of a Hasidic paper who's Hasidic, and he has all the examples in the Hasidic press of pictures of women. Okay, so there wasn't really a Mesorah there as well. But you can't argue with the Mesorah. You know, you play the religion card, you play the Mesorah card. Okay, how can you argue that? But it's not, they are innovations. It is not the Mesorah, but the way that you innovate is to present that as the Mesorah. Is that problematic? Certainly that's problematic. And can Jewish history help? Yes. I literally provided irrefutable evidence of pictures of women in Haredi publications. They were there.
Does Jewish history have other episodes, other chapters, let's say in the 19th century, where something was claimed as Misora, as a defense against Haskalah, perhaps, and it turned out not to be Misora?
It's so tiny, isn't it?
No. Well, you have the problem of the organ at the Altneuschule. And what did they do once it broke? Everybody was much happier for it. And in terms of when a shul has an organ or not, and then everybody agrees, Gemar Beitz and Daf Lamed Vav, about playing music. That's not the issue. I would say that from the perspective of the people trying to claim, and sometimes successfully claiming Masora, they're actually using a word that has not as much currency as another one. Masora is bound up in history. It is our Masora. It is our lineage, our historical reception. They might want to consider using the word authenticity. Authenticity also could mean what Moshe Rabbeinu had done, and that's not exactly what we did. But if we talk about authenticity as a moment, as an experience that's bundled up in so much from the ecosystem in which it exists and the history that is received or not received, then there's a claim to talk about, well, in this moment for this community, an authentically religious experience is as follows. And I don't care much if Dr. Klein posts something on Facebook, because history is important, but it's not the total form of currency needed to justify an authentic experience. If we were to talk about in terms of authenticity, then we'd have, I think, a much more textured conversation. I don't mean to defend, I'm not getting in on the issue, but I think what we miss the mark in these conversations, and what these are not silly people claiming it, but they're just, I think, using a lack, there's lack of precision in the conversation. If we were going to talk about what's authentic, and of course, the idea of women that are missing from pictures is not a Jewish idea. There are many faith communities have the same issue. To offer those parallels is again to think more about authenticity in a moment in time rather than necessarily Masora.
Can I make one just clarification on the question? In my experience, the question is, some rabbanim argue that these innovations aren't keeping with Masora. In my experience, it's actually not the rabbinic leaders who are making those claims.
Mm.
That it's more either
the publisher,
the publisher, someone in the business, just random people who have some social or can put pressure, mm-hmm. random people who are putting pressure on the publishers or someone else. But I don't actually, I have, in my experience, have not seen that coming from the rabbinic leadership.
Interesting.
I'll just say, and I guess this will be, we'll end with this. I mean, this is a very interesting phenomenon, the women's pictures, because, I mean, Sutmer used to have pictures of the Rebbetzin and all these things. Were there, and you could see picture Book of Gedolim. There's a Book of Gedolim that has a whole section of Book of Rebbetzins, and it has in the back pictures of Rebbetzins, and we're talking the early 20th century. So it's a very, the whole phenomenon is interesting in that respect, because it's the created Masora that's against the Masora. But I have a different question, which I've asked people, and I do believe it's a business decision. There's no question. They haven't, this is from bottom up, but it seems that it's a smart business decision, because in certain communities, they will not be able to sell. But something no one's been able to explain, and I've asked people about this from these communities. Okay, so you can't see the woman's picture because it's sexually enticing or things like that. What I don't understand is, then how is it okay? Doesn't this require then to have a woman to wear a hijab? Not a hijab, sorry, a niqab, because, or a burqa? Because if I can't see a face in a picture because what it's going to do to me, then certainly a live woman should be much more. And yet they've never insisted on that. In fact, they regard the people in Israel who do this as the crazies. In fact, these are just these Bali Tshuva women, the Taliban women who've done it. There's no rabbinic authorities, but it should make perfect sense that that's how a woman should dress. If you can't see her picture, as we say, Kal Vachomer, you can't see her live. And also things like a wedding. As far as I know, still the Hasidic weddings, the woman walks down the aisle, everyone's looking at her. How is that sneeze? So I don't, something to me doesn't make sense that the picture is forbidden, but the live face still is permitted. And if anyone knows the answer to this, I'd love to know, because all I'm told is that, well, that's not how we do things.
I don't think that there is an answer more than that. And I think that there is a great hypocrisy in it. I mean, the hypocrisy that women's pictures can't appear in the media, but when it comes to shidduch time, boys can demand a shidduch resume literally to look at a picture and determine if he's attracted to her. That's okay.
And it's not just the face anymore. They want a full body.
Full body shots. Okay? So, of course there's hypocrisy here and something very, very problematic. Let's talk about something else. It's not okay in print, but you know that a lot of these publications have web pages, and the web pages have pictures of women. It's just the print publications can't, because the print publication is where they're trying to market to multiple communities. Whoever goes on the website's more of a self-selecting population, and the assumption is that population doesn't care. And so
the interesting phenomenon is the woman's. Just like in Saudi Arabia, you had plenty of women defending not driving. That now this puts, you know, obviously many of them opposed it, but you always had people who defend it. This puts me on a pedestal. I heard on one of the New York talk shows, you had the religious radio show. It was not Lichtenstein, the other one, Zev Brenner. You have women calling in from communities who don't drive in Kiryas Yoel and places like that, saying this is great. They have to be taken. You know, they put themselves on the pedestal. You will have women defending this practice now, and so to call it misogyny, as many do, it's problematic, because you have internal women now are convinced that this is the best way to treat a woman.
That you're right, and that is a complication, and that is a challenge. Although I think there's room to still say that even if there are women who support it, that doesn't mean that it's a positive change, and that sometimes maybe they haven't seen the full implications.
Dr. Shapiro, Rabbi Dr. Elif, and Dr. Klein, I want to thank you all so much for this really fascinating discussion. And I hope you'll come back to our community soon. Thank you all. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.